The Serious Side of the J. Ryle Show is coming up next, right here on the TJRS Radio Network online radio at its best.
You are listening to the TJRS Radio Network.
WWE Superstar Big Show here to tell you, if you've been drinking, get a ride. Take a cab. Find another safe way to get home. Cops all across the country are cracking down on drunk driving. They will see you before you see them. Drive sober or get pulled over.
Online radio at its best. Online radio at its best.
Hey, 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 guten Tag.
If you're ready, map of the staff.
Let's do this.
I'm telling you, I am first very honored that you would join me tonight.
He has a very limited time spot, so we want to bring in Mr. Alan Sarrow right away.
Hey, how are you, Kathleen?
You know what? I'm going to make you do what it do,
baby. Man, what's crack-a-lackin', baby? What's crack-a-lackin'?
It's time for the Serious Side of the J. Ryle Show.
Don't try to call me out, princess. You can take your love and true purpose and stick it. She's a bitch.
You are listening to the TJRS Radio Network.
This week on the Serious Side.
In its report released Tuesday, the Defense Department estimates some 26,000 service members may have been sexually assaulted last year, with the vast majority of victims not reporting the attack.
Most of these changes were sound. Some caused inconvenience, but some, like expanded surveillance, raised difficult questions about the balance that we strike between our interest in security and our values of privacy. In some cases, I believe we compromised our basic values by using torture to interrogate our enemies and detaining individuals in a way that ran counter to the rule of law. So after I took office, we stepped up the war against Al-Qaeda, but we also sought to change its course. We relentlessly targeted Al-Qaeda's leadership. We ended the war in Iraq and brought nearly 150,000 troops home.
What a lot of people don't realize, when welfare first started, you couldn't have a man in a household. You had to be a single mother in order to get any assistance. If you got married, you would lose your assistance. If you had any man in the household, you would lose your assistance. And this is how they destroyed the black family. Because once you take the father out of the household, there is no family unity.
Good morning and welcome to the Serious Side of the TJRS, broadcasting live from the Smooth Jams Jazz Cafe, right here on the TJRS Radio Network. Good Sunday morning to you folks. Today is May 26, 2013, and you're listening to the Serious Side of the J. Ryle Show, which happens every Sunday morning right here on the TJRS Radio Network, online radio at its best. I'm J. Ryle. Of course, I never share the stage by myself. Let me introduce you to the players. First up, he's gone from most favorite listener to one of our most favorite and most controversial panel members. Let's say good morning to the one and only Steve from Indianapolis. Good morning, Steve. How are you?
Good morning, Jay. Good morning, everyone.
She is the host of the True Purpose Development Show, Ladies First Radio. She's also a cast member on the J. Ryle Show. She's an author of the book Pregnant in the Spirit and a TV personality out of Detroit, Michigan. Let's say good morning to the one and only Dr. Princess Audia. Good morning, Doctor. How are you?
I am doing very well, Jay. Good morning, Jay. Good morning, Steve, and everyone that's listening.
He's the man that gets the first and last word here on the Serious Side, the one that, man, that runs pretty much everything around here. Let's say good morning to the one and only Mr. L.E.S. Good morning, sir. How are you?
Good morning, sir. Good morning, Dr. D, and good morning, Steve.
Good morning. Good morning, Mr.
L.E.S. And good morning to one and all. Today is the day right before Memorial Day. Hope you guys are having a safe holiday weekend. We have a lot to talk about, so let's get right into it. First up, military sexual assault. Okay, there are over 26,000 women in the military who have said, or should I say service members, who have said they've been sexually assaulted this past year. So the question is, let me go to you, Mr. Elias. It's just a very simple question. What can we do? What can the president, or what should happen in the case of all these military service members, mostly women, being sexually assaulted in the military, pretty much with no one or anyone saying anything about it? Not big news for a civilian. So what should we do?
Make the crime fit, the punishment fit the crime, man. I mean, are they sweeping these things under the rugs? Are the military sweeping these things under the rugs? Or, you know, should they put these guys away for, you know, like they do out in the streets? You know, I mean, we're not hearing about it because, you know, it's not publicized. You know, I've heard different. I even seen a movie that John Travolta did where this was happening. And I mean, it seems like it's swept up under the rug, you know. If it's swept up under the rug by the military, shame on them. But these guys that are doing the rape should be doing the time. It should be.
You know, Steve, out of the 26,000 people who said they were sexually assaulted in 2012, the Pentagon only officially counted 3,374 formal allegations. So I'll ask the same question to you. What should be done about this situation?
Well, you may need some legislation. I was currently looking up what's the penalty. But it sounds like there's a bunch of thirsty men running around. You know, you're taking them out of their home environment. You know, they're not around their wives. So, you know, the situation's itchy. Yeah, I'm kind of Google the penalties right now. They may need a bigger penalty for sexual assault. Or maybe you can educate me, Jay. What's the, you know, the penalties on that in the military?
Well, when we talk about penalties, I think one of the big things that's going on right now is that there is talk that they are thinking about taking away the sexual assault part of the military code, the code of military justice, away from the military. There are people who are arguing, saying, no, it needs to remain on the military side. And I think the reason why this has hit the fan, so to speak, Dr. Prince's idea, is because there were two Air Force colonels who dismissed sexually assault cases against two service members, and people are saying this is the good old boys club. You know, Steve said something that, you know, even though, you know, I mean, I hear what he's saying, but there is some truth or validity to that statement. The fact that you have all these men in these places and you have these female soldiers. And I'm, to be perfectly honest with you, me being a former service member, I'm shocked that the numbers are that high, because I know that one thing that they did not tolerate while I was in the military, you couldn't do that. I mean, it was just one of those things that were off the table. And for these numbers to be so blatant and to be so outrageous, I mean, my goodness, what the hell is going on in the U.S. military, Dr. Princess Abia?
Well, the good old boy system. I mean, it seems like, I mean, I don't know. I've never been in the service, but I can only go by what I see. And
speaking from a woman's perspective, when you think about this, speaking from a woman's perspective, give us your thoughts.
Well, from a woman's perspective, I can't say racist. It's not racist, but I mean, they're treating them bad. They're not. Putting them on the same level of, they're not giving them, the women, the same respect that they are giving the men. And it, to me, it seems like it's sort of like they're trying to push them out, because I don't think that men really want the women in the service in the first place. And they're pushing them out, and they're giving them reasons. They're ignoring what is important and relevant. I think in the service, that's when you decide if you want to be in the service, lady, that you put all of that aside, and it's a silent cold. You know, I mean, it's a silent cold. It's sort of like being a cop, sort of like the cops, for example. I know around here, people will say things like, if a cop gets in trouble, don't even worry about it, because the cop is going to get away with it, and the civilian is the one that's going to pay for it if the cop does something wrong. And they have this system. And you take them to court, forget about it, because they're friends with the judges and everyone else and the attorneys. I think in when you're talking about the military and women, although I do believe that women should be able to go to the military without any problem, I don't believe that there is a level of respect for them in the military, regardless of what laws are laid down, et cetera, because of the mindset of the people. It's a lot of old people. They've been there for years, you know, in the system, and it's, you know, it's going to take some time for them to kind of, I think, I don't know, time, a long time, even still, for them to give women the same respect that they give men in the military. I don't, I mean, so what is the law? I think they have to, the women there, I mean, I know they're standing up more and more and more, but I'm one for hope, but I'm just going to say, I mean, it's just not the same level of respect, I don't feel, at all. And to me, to write a law down, it's like, okay, so fine, and what? It still doesn't protect them.
You know, one of the things, Ms. Elias, that people accuse me of when we had this conversation about military women serving in forward units or combat units, you know, one of the things that I, you know, I'm against that to a certain degree because, you know, because once again, I understand the makeup of the military. You know, when I was in, women could not go into what we call infantrymen barracks. You know, if you were a guy that was on the front lines, you were not allowed to have women in your barracks. And, you know, and this is the reason why I always felt that it would be a problem having women in combat, because you are in situations where you may be isolated from the rest. You may be on an outpost somewhere, and here you are, these, you know, hormones are hormones. People are going to do things that are, you know, that are pretty much against the law, and they're going to break the law, and they're going to, you know, listen, that's why we have rape. That's why a lot of the things exist in our society, because a person puts a uniform on doesn't necessarily mean that, you know, they are a perfect law-abiding citizen. I mean, there are a lot of crimes in the military, and to me, this is a situation where people who are against females being in combat, to me, this gives fodder to their argument. Do you not agree?
I disagree wholeheartedly. So what you're saying is that because they're females, they shouldn't be allowed to do their job, and because you got some horny man that wants to pounce on a woman, she shouldn't be allowed to do her job. Well, hell, you got women in corporate offices too. Should they not allowed to be do their job? I mean, I understand that combat and corporate offices are entirely different.
Completely
different. I understand that. But if this woman is there to do her job, man, and let her do her job, she shouldn't be raped because she wants to be a combat soldier. She shouldn't be raped because, I mean, that's like telling your daughter, hey, you can't be president because a man wants to do these things to you. You know, that's completely bull. I mean, I don't agree with females in combat. You don't get me wrong. You know, I because of the rape factor, but hell, man, these are their own soldiers raping these females. But now, how ridiculous is that? This is a United States soldier raping their own females and their own units, and then the commander's covering his crap up. I mean, where's the injustice? Where's the justice at for these women? I mean, it's got to be some justice there.
Yeah, but, and I understand what you're saying, but you know, you contradict yourself a little bit, because that's not my main reason for not wanting women in combat, because I really and truly believe that you mentioned something about, you know, doing their jobs, and it's hard, in my opinion, for a female to carry a 50 caliber, you know, machine gun. It's hard for those types of things. I just don't think the woman's body structure is made up to do that. But I don't want to go down that avenue, because I understand that people will, you know,
yeah,
people
I
have
was getting ready
for,
to say something.
Yeah, I understand. That, but you know, you never served. So I mean, the bottom line is that it's hard if you're in the theater to be able to do some of the things that male soldiers can do. I mean, that's just a fact. I'm not making this up. But you know, staying on the point of sexual harassment, 1 in 26 women are sexual assaults have gone down in the military. And the bottom line is that the Defense Department looks as if they are covering these things up. And for the Pentagon to only have 3,300 formal allegations versus the 2,600 service members who were polled separately who said they have been a victim of some type of sexual assault. To me, Steve, it kind of goes back to corporate America, because you do have, remember that movie with Michael Douglas, and I can't remember the female that was in it. Was it Demi Moore? You know, the bottom line is that it happens regardless of whether you wear a suit to work every day or if you wear a uniform to work every day. What say you?
Well, yes, and that's why I believe, are these the 30,000 that necessarily did not file charges against these men? And I remember I had buddies that went to the military, and they were going off base having sex with the female soldiers off base, which is, I know it's totally an entirely different thing, but, are they afraid to file charges? What's the penalty? And it's not civilian law, just all these, up in the air issues, if you're around thirsty dudes and, they haven't seen their wives in so long and girlfriends, it's gonna be an issue, but there's no excuse though, So yeah, it is a risk, especially if women want to go to the military. Their risk is there, but as Jay, you're right. All over America, women are being sexually assaulted. This goes beyond the military. It's all over the country. Sexual assault has been on the rise. Pedophilia, sexual harassment is on the rise as well, Jay. So to me, maybe we're in a different culture. What do you think about the culture?
Well, I think it's a situation where, the bottom line is, it's just like when you hear about the casting couch in Hollywood. I think it's a situation where, men, in order for them to, women, in order for them to get to certain places, some of them accept this type of behavior because they know that, okay, and I'm not saying this is right, wrong, or indifferent, so I don't want anyone to misinterpret what I'm saying here. What I'm saying is it exists in the military. The reason why it's not being reported, because women are concerned about, okay, if I report this, if I sleep with this journal, then, who knows? Now, keep in mind, what you see in Hollywood and what actually happens in the military is two completely different things, because once you get to a certain level in the military, then, your merits and your advancement is based at the Department of the Army Headquarters DA, so it's not something that's handled at a local level. So, and there are regulations in place to make sure that certain things are being done the right way. However, there are still advantages to if a man comes and does something to you and you don't report it. If he's a squad leader, if he's a platoon leader, if he's a platoon sergeant, he can make life easy for you. So maybe that's the reason why they're not reporting, Dr. Princess Aldi. I know you wanted to say something. The floor is yours.
Well, you say that's the reason they're not reporting. You mean the men are not reporting what's happening?
That's the reason why I think the females are not reporting what's going on, because once again, 2,600 women or 2,600 service members have said they've been sexually assaulted, but the Pentagon only has 3,300 on their books. You explain to me the disparity in those numbers.
So you're saying that basically the women are admitting to the sexual assault, but they've fallen beholden to the sexual assault because of the opportunity of moving forward? Is that what you're saying?
I'm saying that I'm trying to come up with a logical explanation as to why those numbers are so off-centered. And I don't know. I'm taking educated guesses. That's the reason why we're having the conversation. I have no clue why. Could it be a situation where they reported it and the man said, hey, we're not going to do anything about it. That could be the case as well. I don't know. I'm just saying to you is that what's the answer? What's from the outside looking in, if we had to take an educated guess as to what's going on, what's going on?
I was confirming what you said, because I kind of I can kind of go with that I think that's a possibility. But in that case, then is it really sexual assault? It is sexual assault, but it is sexual assault. Yes, it is. Even
what do you mean?
I had a sexual assault case before, and it well I didn't go with it, though. You know, I said something, and it was, you know, the person admitted that they did it, but they got a slap on the wrist, you know. So it was like, I mean, on the wrist. So it was a really, it was really interesting. So I can actually kind of, I can relate to that. I can relate to feeling so scared to say something because of the rank of a person and the repercussions that can come to you as a result of their rank. And it's like, okay, do I say something or do I not? Do I just go along with this, you know, or you know, or not? I chose not to go along with it, but again, the person got a slap on the wrist even though they admitted it. And so I can relate to that, and I could say maybe that is the case. And then I would say another portion of the numbers that are probably not showing just because people within the ranks are hiding for each other and putting it under the rug. Mm-hmm. So it never makes it to where it needs to go, you know, the information, because the people in the ranks are, you know, with the old man system, and they're keeping it under the rug.
Absolutely. I mean, you're absolutely correct with that. It's 21 minutes after the hour. You're listening to the Serious Side of the Jay Ryle Show. The phone number is 347-850-1272, 347-850-1272. We're talking about military sexual harassment. Let's bring in our political strategist from EspreeRadio.net, my man, Jerome Espree. Jerome, good morning. How are you? Do we have Jerome with us, Ms. Elias?
Yes.
Yes, sir.
Okay.
I was on
okay.
mute, so I wouldn't
know.
But good morning. How you doing?
Good morning. How are you, sir? So we're talking about this whole thing. 2,600 people said they were sexually assaulted in 2012, but yet the Pentagon's only showing 3,300. If you had to take an educated guess here, Jerome, what would you say the issues are with this?
Oh, man. I would say that they're just covered. It's been covered up for, you know, since probably the beginning of time. Like, that's the issue with power, and when you're in organizations that close ranks like that, it is very difficult to even get a real number, because we know that that happens, and women have 60 Minutes used to do features on that since the 70s, you know, of stuff that happened to women in the military, and everyone act like it didn't happen, you know, and that's part of the culture of what led to the whole don't ask, don't tell stuff too as well, because they don't really... The military does not want to talk about the any of the enlisted men, well, anybody in the military, when it comes to sex or any extracurricular activities, them drinking, bar fights. They won't talk about anything outside of military, and everything else gets swept under the rug. I mean, everything else. So you don't really hear anything, drug use, you won't hear alcoholism, you won't hear anything really on numbers coming out of military, because they don't like to stay covered up.
Yeah, and you're right about that. I mean, there is a lot of that. I think the movie that a lot of people always point to is Few Good Men, how that whole story, you know, shook out. And even though it was Hollywood, it was pretty close to real life. And as far as Don't Ask, Don't Tell, I think there may have been a poor part of that. But the main thing behind Don't Ask, Don't Tell was the fact that you had military commanders targeting soldiers who they thought were gay. And so, you know, we've talked about it here on the show before, whereas, you know, they put Don't Ask, Don't Tell in place originally to protect homosexuals, because at that time that meant that commanders could not walk up to a soldier that they felt was gay and ask them that question, because once they ask the question, once you're given a lawful order, you have to abide by that order. And so that was a fail-safe, but eventually, you know, we've talked about this before, eventually it turned into a situation where, you know, gay soldiers felt that they were being asked not to be able to live their life to its fullest, and, you know, things of that nature.
I mean, I didn't want to compare them in detail because I don't really know too much about that. But here's what I do know. Women are targeted, too. So I was making it from the standpoint of targeting anything about anything outside of military service. That is the issue. Like, that women, when it comes down to it, when you have a bunch of men commanders or men in power, whether it's in corporate, sexual harassment is kind of what you have to watch out for, but how do you regulate it? I wouldn't say it's difficult. You have to get somebody who probably sexually harassed somebody else to turn somebody in for sexual harassment, and that's difficult.
It's like discrimination. I mean,
exactly.
You know, when you, like for me, working for a company where I knew that the people were racist that were in my, the VPs and those guys, how could I actually complain to somebody that escalates to them so that they make a decision on something that happens to me? So it's one of those things where sexual harassment in the military or any kind of anything that has to do with gender in the military is, I don't know how you regulate that. I really just kind of say you can put somebody in charge to oversee it, but they can be corrupted just as easy as anyone else. I don't know.
Exactly. And you're right. I mean, you know, and you have people in power, and that's the reason why I felt that. You know, one of the things they always talk about with the military, you know, the military is so close to corporate America because, you know, you still have those structures. You still have chains of commands. You still have those types of things. Let's get out to the phone lines. Let's bring a caller in that I think he has some military experience. His name is Ray. He's calling from Texas. Good morning, Ray. Welcome to the Serious Side. How are you?
All right. Glad to be on the show. One thing I want to say, I served 8 years in the military.
Okay.
Okay, and I want to know what, I didn't see it ramping like that. I really want to see the statistics on how it relates back to civilian society's numbers because people got to understand two things. Number one, soldiers don't fall under normal constitutional law. You fall under the Uniform Code of Military Justice. So it's totally different. It's a different world. Mm-hmm. And that, I think actually that can be good and bad at the same time, okay? Because a lot of things are at the commander's discretion on what to charge a soldier would or not. But when I was in, sexual harassment was so strong that really most people avoided women during the business day. So it was like in general. Matter of fact, I was called out by a couple of my female soldiers because I really didn't. I was so like standoffish with them, you know, because it was like, hey, you know, he just didn't want to be bothered with him at all because it's just like you don't want anything to be misconstrued as sexual harassment. But there's somehow I just don't like the fact that people thinking that it's just so wild that soldiers are just raping all these women. It's not happening. I can't see it being like that because here's another thing: people are the laws are different because what's considered. You could have, I knew people who were in different rank structures, like higher rank that were in relationships with lower ranking soldiers, and that could be considered rape, you know, because it is based on their position over them. So it's like, that don't mean the people are out here, we need to see the real numbers, because I don't think that soldiers are out here just raping women, like, because I was there for 8 years, and I just didn't see that. And I was in an infantry unit, hardcore. So what's it like? You know, I don't get it. And I was a third ID, so I was in the most rapidly deployed unit in the United States Army.
Yeah.
Third Infantry Division out of Fort Stewart, Georgia. So I really want to see where these numbers are coming from. I don't get it.
That's a good point, man. Thank you so much for serving, and we appreciate you calling, man. Continue to listen. Appreciate you. Thank you so much. And, you know, and Ray said something that I think that makes all the sense in the world, because he served 8 years. I served 14, and it's the same thing. We didn't see it. It wasn't as rampant as these numbers. These numbers are mind-blowing, Mr. Elias, when I sit back and listen to them, because like Ray said, you know, one of the things that, let me tell you, the two things in the military that the military really stressed, especially when I was in, if a soldier mentioned the word suicide, all things stopped. Because you wanted to make sure that that soldier did not, you know, continue along with that action. And then, you know, once again, sexual harassment, it was something that was just not tolerated, and you saw the long arm of the law. However, I mentioned before we brought Ray in, the movie, you know, A Few Good Men, and even though, like I said, it's Hollywood, but let's say that it's a high-ranking, you know, very distinguished officer. Do you not think they're going to take, you know, those types of steps to make sure that this person's not embarrassed? Hell, look what just happened this past week with Celia. It's a guy who's responsible for sexual assault in the Air Force was arrested for sexual assault. You last word on this set.
Well, you know something? I'll put it like this, man. Maybe back in the day it was different with you guys. Like you know, a lot of things have changed in the military. You know, like, you know, you guys, you know, have been able to discipline a soldier. So maybe the rules have changed. Maybe things, different structures have hit the military, as far as sexual harassment goes. Now, maybe everything has changed. So, you know, maybe things need to go back to the way they were, because right now, if you get 26,000 women that have been sexually assaulted, then something's going wrong, and there's only... The Pentagon is only reporting 3,000, and something's wrong with the math there. You know, I'm not the greatest mathematician in the world, but hell, the bottom line is, if you're only accounting for that many people being raped in the Pentagon, then you're hiding something. Things need to stop going down the road that they're going down.
Yeah, absolutely. Well said. And the 26,000 service members to be make sure that we're correct on that. All right, folks. Look, one set done, but we're not done. We're not complete. We're not even near the end by no stretch of the imagination. Coming up next, we're going to talk about the Obama Doctrine. What is it? We'll look into it next on the serious side of the J. Ryle Show. Don't go anywhere.
This is your resident map of the South, Moms and Little Daughters, kickstarting your weekend every Friday with Ladies First Radio, The J. Ryle Show, a show for women, by women. Tune in every Friday, 7 p.m. Central Standard Time, 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, as my co-host, Princess Odelia, and I discuss everyday issues and offer inspirational solutions. From the East Coast to the West Coast to all over the world, Ladies First Radio keeps it real, spreading positivity one show at a time. So come be uplifted with Ladies First Radio, The J. Ryle Show. Every Friday, 7 p.m. Central Standard Time, 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. That's Ladies First Radio, The J. Ryle Show. A show for women, by women.
Most of these changes were sound. Some caused inconvenience, but some, like expanded surveillance, raised difficult questions about the balance that we strike between our interests in security and our values of privacy. And in some cases, I believe we compromised our basic values by using torture to interrogate our enemies and detaining individuals in a way that ran counter to the rule of law. So after I took office, we stepped up the war against Al-Qaeda, but we also sought to change its course. We relentlessly targeted Al-Qaeda's leadership. We ended the war in Iraq and brought nearly 150,000 troops home.
It's 37 minutes after the hour. You're listening to The Serious Side of the J. Rouse Show. Happens every Sunday morning. Right here on the TGRS Radio Network, online radio at its best. Our call-in number is 347-850-1272, 347-850-1272. You can be a part of the conversation. Just tell us your name and where you're calling from, and we'd be more than happy to listen to you or talk to you. Let's say good morning to everyone. Once again, let's say good morning to Steve from Indianapolis. Good morning, Steve.
Good morning, everyone.
Good morning, Dr. Princess Aldea.
Good morning. Good morning.
Good morning to our political strategist, Jerome Esprit. Good morning.
Good morning. Yep, good morning.
And, of course, the man who gets the first and last word, my main man, Mr. Elias. Good morning, sir.
Good morning, everyone.
Don't forget now, coming up, our annual conversation about the state of Black America. Today we're focusing on the Black family. That's coming up next. Plus, before we go, and Chatterbox, your final thoughts from the chat room. We'd love to hear from you, either on the chat room or any social network. Just leave us some information. We may read your comments on the air. Right now we're talking about the Obama Doctrine. You know, earlier this week the president gave a speech about the U.S. involvement in the war on terror. It sounded to me, and let me go to you on this one first, Steve, it sounded to me that this is a president that, yeah, he's the commander-in-chief, and yeah, he's out there really being aggressive with terrorists, but it sounds to me that there's some things he would like to change. I think that he regrets the fact that Gitmo is still open, you know, in his second term, well into his second term. I think that he also has a problem with some of the things we do when it comes to torture. Let's start the conversation with you, Steve. What are your thoughts on this particular topic?
Well, you know, see, it strengthens the Democrat Party when we start getting into the civil liberties issue. I mean, you have Code Pink, you have political movements that are very dissatisfied with the Democrat Party. And so I kind of see it as a political move to strengthen the base of the Democrat Party. By making the speeches, but to strengthen civil, it's going to actually take legislation. It's going to take action. So the speech, yes, it you'll have the Code Pink members and different groups out there that'll feel they'll sleep a little better tonight. You know, sleep a little better this week. They slept better this week, but they're looking for legislative action because the Republican Party has been benefiting from these. These groups that focus on civil liberties and focus on, you know, that the ACLU and different things of that nature. It strengthens the Democrat Party. I know, and so maybe Jerome can go into that, or maybe you can, Jay. What do you think about that, Jay?
Well, I don't know. It seems to me that what you're saying, and someone else helped me with this, and I want to make sure that I'm hearing him correctly. It sounds to me what he's saying is, what you're saying, Steve, is that, you know, the president, he doesn't really feel this way. It's a situation where, you know, he's trying to strengthen the base, and so he's saying things, giving the base catnip, so to speak, because of whatever reasons. And I don't know. I really and truly believe, Jerome, that this is how this president feels about this. And I think that, you know, the more and more as he, you know, as we continue into his second term, you're going to get these type of revelations.
Well, I don't know how, I don't really know where to begin here, but I think what happens is, you know, we've been in war mode for so long that
right.
When you change policy, like you do things that you need to do when you're in the middle of conflict, And then once conflict kind of settles and you're not chasing as much as you used to, you can change course. You can say, we're still going after people, but there's no war on terror like that. That is something that the Bush folks does, and I think Republicans do very well, is scaring everybody to death. And I think that with what the president kind of does, and good or bad, I don't know if this is a good or bad thing, but what he does is he's saying, based on his personality, we are not just hunting people just to hunt them. Like, we don't have no war on anybody. Anybody takes a shot at us, we're going after them. So he's changing the tone the conversation a little bit, and he's choosing his words differently. So, in which I think he always has. So as soon as he took away the terror alert, you know, green, blue, and whatever those codes were, he was telling you right then he wasn't really big on scaring the public. That's just not what he does. And so it's not that I don't think it's to pacify anybody. I don't think it's like to pacify the base of the Democratic Party. I think that stuff that political people say to blame one way or another. But what happens is that everybody aligns with a certain group, and it helps one group to hear certain talk, and it doesn't help others to hear certain talk. So when the president changes or starts to say what he thinks and how he governs, well, we're about to see how he governs, but it did take him to get past about 5 years of, you know, rhetoric, or and it, not from his part, but from that high alert of terrorism and financial crisis. And once you got past that, nobody's talking about that. Everybody's talking about scandals since the financial systems are doing better, right? And so it just shows that there's always a fire, and you're always having to toggle between different philosophies. But I think what he's just doing, even the whole concept of taking the drone stuff away from the CIA, the CIA can run rampant on you if you remember anything about or have any history about the Reagan administration on what Oliver North and those guys did when the CIA was just going in, snatching people and upsetting governments. That is technically outside of the framework of our checks and balances. So to bring that back under the Pentagon, now you can have hearings because they would have to justify every time they use a drone, but you don't on the CIA side. And again, like even in Benghazi, you know, to know that that was a CIA operation going on, of course the president doesn't know the details of it until he shakes the CIA and they tell him what they want to tell him. So I think when he does this, he is just saying, here is the way I see the world, and he's just changing course a little bit. Well, I shouldn't say he's changing course. He's taking it from an active fire situation, and he's realigning the fire department. That's pretty much how I look at it.
Now, you know, Mr. Elias, one of the things I will say is that, you know, where the Republicans are going to start saying that, you know, the president, here he is, he's weak, you know, he's taking a different approach than the Bush-Cheney administration. You know, I mean, from a political standpoint, you know, what is he facing as far as political headwinds when he comes out and makes this type of speech?
Well, you know what, Jay, you could say he's weak. But, you know, look at his track record.
I'm not saying this week. I'm saying that the Republicans might be saying that.
Okay. Whoever's saying that he's weak, they can say he's weak. But look at his track record. And compare it to the Bush and the Cheney track record. You know, all they did was create a war. This man has went after terrorists and has tracked terrorists down and has killed terrorists, you know, the terrorist leaders. So, you know, we can sit here and say how weak he is on terrorism. But we can compare records between the Bush and the Cheney, and there is no comparison. So, if I was gonna use the argument, that would be my argument right there.
You know, Dr. Prentice, what's wrong with the U.S. taking more of a diplomatic approach when it comes to these types of things? The president said in his speech, look, we have to be careful. We can't go after every group of people who say they are affiliated with Al-Qaeda. You know, there could be a group of thugs, and to use this term, thugs out there trying to, you know, bait the U.S. into some type of long-term war. So, you know, he's looking at this from a whole different approach, is he not?
Yes. I really love it. And I know some of this is going to come from my usual tone of inspiration, but this is what I'm going to say. When I think about our president, I think of someone who
is not using his position. He doesn't react emotionally to things. He seems to always come from a strategic and wise space when he makes his choices, when he talks to us, and I'm going to say he talks to us. You know, he's making his speeches. He has made it very clear that he's for the people. He is concerned about the people, regardless of what kind of people you are. And he has created that energy. So when he comes forth and he gives a conversation of something that may yield change in the way we view war, the way people view us and our intentions, which also diffuses war, I think that it's very strategic and wise. He's not emotional. And we have always responded in many cases on this, with regards to war. Yes, we have to. Yes, if somebody attacks us, yes, we have to go back and we got to get them, okay? But even with that, he used strategic and wisdom in his approach. But I think a lot of times there has been wars that, you know, we didn't need to have the war. We just didn't need it. It was emotional. It was just we didn't need to have a war. And when we come from a defensive side all the time, I believe that can create certain reactions in other places. So I really, with regard to President Barack Obama and his speech, I did not hear the speech, but knowing him and as we talk about the war and him even coming a little lightly with it, I don't think it's so much light as it is just coming from a non-emotional, wise, and strategic space and viewpoint when he is approaching this. He's creating a change that can be long-term. We have to do something. We can't go around just fighting everybody, you know, and people wanting to fight us. It creates a battle at times when it doesn't need to be. So I think that I'm so on point with him. I'm glad that he is making a different choice, or not even a different choice, but he's doing how he needs to do, and he's being very, very consistent to how he has been throughout his terms. So he's being very consistent. He's for the people. He's for peace. He's for love. And however it has to happen, I believe that he's taking a very wise, strategic, non-emotional approach about it.
You know, Steve, let me ask you a question. So now, what do you think our allies are thinking? And the president makes this speech. You know, we've always said that we are the police of the world. Are they feeling better about the United States at this point? Or do they have concerns that here's a president who's saying, look, I'd rather talk than, you know, come in with tanks a-blazing? What say you?
Well, Jay, the thing is, trust in government is at an all-time low. So this can also be used to bolster confidence and trust in government. So we have that situation, you know. But I always say I look at actions and not speeches. You know, what you say versus what you sign into law could be different between night and day. Executive orders, I also look at that. So need to see action. And you know, we can sit here and talk about civil liberties and all that all day long, but at the end of the day, we need action. We need executive orders coming out the executive branch. We need to see legislation. Otherwise, this is just, you know, people sleep a little better this week, and trust in government goes up a couple percentage points, and then everybody goes home and goes to back to daily life. So action versus speeches. And you know, that's big to me, you know. It's real big when we take action, because politicians are they're known for just coming over and trying to change the whole political mood. They're known for that. They're kind of like preachers, you know. This Sunday, the message is this. Next week, we're going to deal with cheating on your wives. And, you know, it's just, you know, they heard enough of speech. We need some action on civil liberties. That's my comment, Jay.
You know, Jerome, you one of the things that I love when you say, and I think people tend to forget this, because the man is sitting, you know, at the White House, you know, he's not the king of the United States. He's the president of the United States. He cannot sit here and make law. And people seem to think that, okay, well, the president has to do this. Yeah, he's the man that's in charge, but we all know that's the reason why Congress is doing what they're doing, is because they like playing the role of spoiler. They're like being the ones that they love, especially Republicans, they love having gridlock in government.
That's right. And a bigger part of that is just like, you know, talking about Gitmo or Guantanamo Bay closing. He's tried to close it. Congress will not let it happen.
Right.
Right? And so you want to talk about the impression of government. No, his numbers are good. It is Congress's, when you talk about government, you can't paint them all with the same brush. Congress numbers stink. They're at all-time lows, not the numbers for the president. Right? And so you can see one side doing something, the other side doing another. And that's when you keep creating your own fights. Like, we have a sequester now, and that was totally caused by Congress. It was caused because they couldn't get their act together. They tried to force themselves to do the right thing, but since people aren't hurting enough, they're not going to do jack. They're taking vacations. They're doing everything that they want to do. And you can't blame the president for that, because he needed to have them raise that debt ceiling. Right, so you trade one crisis for the other, and one side of your government is literally just fighting the legacy of another one. And that is more of a problem than anything else. So you can't paint them all with the same brush when you look at the I mean, and part of this, some of that number may be in a sequester, but if you look at on the federal side or on the executive side, actually having $113 billion surplus last month, that is crazy. And they say, you know, government doesn't have money. So when the president says, hey, I'm going to do this program, they have $113 billion with a B dollar surplus last month. So the federal on the, you know, president side, he can do some things. But when they spend money domestically, Congress has to allocate those funds, and they're not doing jack. So now that we have a bridge collapse and then another bridge collapse, then everybody's going to cry and say, how come we're not spending money in infrastructure, when we know for the last 3 years the president's kept saying, put the infrastructure money in the budget. We need to fix our infrastructure. And they said, no, just sitting on it. Right? But everybody's going to blame the president. But at the same time, he knows that. And so he's going to be responsible to not really point the finger. But we, especially media folks, those of us who know better, we have to be able to answer those questions, to say, here's where you need to look. You need to press your congressmen and your senators. So when we start blaming the president for things that the congressmen and senators are doing, it is our fault for not understanding how government runs. You know, and again, we probably need to put civics back in school.
Yeah, absolutely. It's 5 before the hour. You're listening to The Serious Side of the Jay Rouse Show. Happens every Sunday morning right here on the TGRS Radio Network. Online radio at its best, 347-850-1272 is our calling number, 347-850-1272. If you've called into the show and you want to make another comment, by all means, just press 1 and then press 1 again. That way, that will let us know that you want to get back in. We'd be more than happy to get you in. We're talking about the Obama Doctrine right about now. Now, Mr. Elias, we've had this conversation as well, the U.S. being the world police. Could it be a situation where the president started looking at these defense numbers saying, hey, come on now, bottom line is that we continue to sit here and talk about we have deficits and we have these types of things. You know, Jerome just brought it up as far as bridges collapsing, we need to spend time and money on our infrastructure. But the bottom line is that our defense budget, our defense spending is ridiculous.
It's going to continue to be ridiculous, too, because, you know, half the people say they would rather be safe than sorry. Look, how much safe do you have to be when you outspend the next people by so many of the billions of dollars, man? It's just ridiculous. You know, and you got, you know, you got so many reports saying how many bridges are unsafe in the United States. One just fell in California. You know, this is ridiculous to me, where you don't put the money where it belongs. You know, if you really want to know where it belongs on infrastructure and it belongs on education. But we're not spending the money on education. We're spending the money on defense, which is to me is the most ridiculous thing in the world. Why would the world police
I understand why somebody has to be the world police, but why do we have to spend so much money on wars and everything else? It's ridiculous to me.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's get back out to the phone lines. Looks like Ray from Texas has a comment. Ray, you're back low and live. Good morning. What's your comment?
I was just going to say, it's a couple of different things. The reason when it comes to defense spending, the reality of it comes down to jobs and power, okay? Nobody wants to lose that factory that makes tanks. Nobody wants those people to lose their jobs. So be it Democrats nor Republicans, how they going to ever give up that defense spending when it comes to those contracts that go to Boeing, Lockheed Martin, and all the different suppliers of the different parts and stuff. So it's like we can't have it both ways, you know. And so it just so happens that the pork that the Republicans have is on the defense spending side, you know. That's their baby, but along with some Democrats, too, that have defense contractors in their states. But also when it comes to education, one of the biggest myths is that we don't spend enough money on education. The problem with our country is the value of education has declined. You know, I mean, we have to import engineers in from India and China. They still teach math class in the United States, but of course, people here aren't taking the hard sciences because you have more psychology majors than doggone engineering majors. And it's not a shortage of engineering programs. So it's like we're the hypocrites. A lot, we blame government, but what are we doing? I mean, that's the key thing. What are we doing as individuals to increase our own job prospects? Because every single American, I work in higher education, had, if you're poor, you have up to $15,050 a year to go to school for something. You know? So the poor community, so it's not a shortage of money in education. Take Chicago. You have the average public school teacher in Chicago makes $79,000 a year. So it's not that the teachers are underpaid in a lot of places across the country. It's just the fact that we're not taking advantage of it, and people are coming here, African immigrants, Indian immigrants, people from all over the world, benefiting from our system and basically having exponential success. And it's a fact.
Yeah. All right. Appreciate it once again, Ray. And for those who may, you know, once again, if you're on hold, definitely, once we let you in, you can, you know, press 1, get back off of hold, and then definitely let us know that you're back. Massilia, it sounded like you wanted to say something.
Yeah, well, we're talking about Chicago. They're closing, like, 60 schools in Chicago. You know, if we want to talk about education, the lower-level education is not there. You know, if you look at the movie Finding Superman, the lower-level education is not there. You know, okay, there's money for college, but what about the lower-level education? That's my point.
The issue there, Chicago has ran up so much debt, the interest they're paying on their debt is so high. They, you know, that's another thing. We have local governments that run up debt so high. And then the bridge situation, the engineers are responsible and on the state government to inspect the bridges. So when the bridges collapse, they blame the federal. But who is supposed to inspect the bridge? The state government. If they don't do the job, it collapses, then they blame the federal. And then,
we can run up the debt for military spending, but not for a child's education.
No, I'm saying in Chicago, that's a special situation. The state of Illinois' debt is so high. The interest they're paying on that debt is so high because they maxed out the credit card and kept going. That you know, the Republican states are paying lower interest rates than the Democrat states because the Democrat states ran up high debt levels. That's another reason why a lot of schools are closing in these Democratic districts. Because they ran up high debt.
Let me step in here because I think we're veering a little bit off course here. And I understand that. Listen, conversation.
Why Illinois is so bad?
No, I understand.
Right now.
I understand. But the thing is that you know, and that's what happens when people have conversations. When you sit down, usually you start someplace and then you end up going somewhere else. So, look, I'm not opposed to the conversation, but, you know, as the host, I need to try to get us back on point. So tell you what we're going to do. We're going to give Dr. Princess O.D. the final word on this, because I definitely want to get into our third topic, because every year we do this, we talk about the state of Black America. This year, we're going to focus on the African-American family. So, Dr. Princess O.D., why don't you give me the last word on this set, and then we'll continue moving right along.
Okay. Well, as I said earlier, I believe that our president is using a very strategic, wise, non-emotional standard in his approach as it relates to war. Yes, we may have too much money going towards war, but I think that may even change as he begins to really make clear his position as president and what he plans to move forward in the reactions that the United States has as it relates to war. I think that it's something that we all can take honor in. As I'm going to say Martin Luther King. When there was war and there was battle in the movement, he did not react emotionally. There were times that there were people that were on his side that were, you know, wanting him to take a reaction because somebody had done something evil to one of the people, one of the marchers or something. And he would always say, you know, sometimes he would say, look, we're not even going to march for a few days because we want to promote peace. And I really look at the approach that our president, Barack Obama, is taking. I believe that it is going to, over time, it's going to infuse a different reaction, response, and energy throughout the United States. And guess what, people? That's what we need right now. And when you change the energy, you also have opportunity for prosperity. So understand that. That's going to yield us a prosperous country and a unity throughout the world. Let's accept it.
Appreciate it. All right, folks, coming up next, the state of Black America. You're listening to The Serious Side right here on the TGRS Radio Network.
This is a test.
As we jump into the second set with laughter, a hearty laughter from Tommy Styles. Welcome back in, folks. 347-850-1272.
Show for women, by women. Is your resident map of the South, Mom and Little Donna.
Good Sunday morning to you, folks, and welcome into the Serious Side of the TJRS, broadcasting live from the Smooth Jazz Jazz Cafe.
Powerhouse Sports Talk Radio.
Welcome back. You are tuning in to the True Purpose Development Show tonight.
You are listening to the TJRS Radio Network. Thank you.
What a lot of people don't realize, when welfare first started, you couldn't have a man in a household. You had to be a single mother in order to get any assistance. If you got married, you would lose your assistance. If you had any man in the household, you would lose your assistance. And this is how they destroyed the black family. Because once you take the father out of the household, there is no family unity.
It's 10 minutes after the hour. You're listening to the Serious Side of the J. Ryle Show. Happens every Sunday morning right here on the TJRS Radio Network, online radio at its best. Our call-in number is 347-850-1272, 347-850-1272. You can participate in the conversation. Let's say good morning one last time to our panelists. Let's say good morning to Steve from Indianapolis. Good morning, Steve.
Good morning, everyone.
Good morning, Dr. Princess Audia.
Good morning, everyone.
Good morning, Jerome Esprit.
Yeah, good morning.
And, of course, good morning to the one and only Mr. Elias. Good morning, sir.
Good morning, all.
Don't forget, now, your comments can be heard on the air live. All you have to do is just leave a comment, either here in the chat room, or you can leave a comment on some of the social media websites that we monitor, and if they are good enough, we will read them during the chatterbox section of the show. And, of course, we do have a segment call before we go. We take a quick look at some stories that made headlines this past week. But right now, we're getting into an annual conversation that we have every year here on the Serious Side, at least twice a year. It's the State of Black America. And in this segment, we want to focus our discussion on the African-American family. Where are we heading as a unit? You know, you heard on the lead-in talking about welfare and, you know, welfare destroyed the black family. The thing that always bothers me, Jerome, when people talk about welfare and they associate welfare with African-Americans is that if you really kind of look at the numbers, you know, welfare really is geared more towards poor white families, but yet and still it's one of those stigmas that have been attached to, you know, African-American families, that African-American families are on welfare. And those statements are just false. Did I lose Jerome? Is he still with us? Yeah, let's. Hopefully he'll get his audio together. But let me go to you, Dr. Princess O'Neill. Once again, we associate welfare and all those things with the African-American family, but, you know, statistics tell us something completely different. Your thoughts?
When you say statistics tell us something different, I don't know how could it tell us something different, because that seems to be the thing. And I was thinking that when the clip was going on, I'm thinking to myself, it's so sad that when you talk about welfare, it's immediately an association to the black family. And as it's crushed. It's crushed. I mean, okay, so we say when they were able to have ADP initially or financial assistance in the beginning, that it would break up the family. And basically a person couldn't get, once they got married, they couldn't get the financial assistance. I mean, I could look, some could look at that to say, well, you know, guess what? You know, you have a man in the house, go get a job. And as I say that just now, I then am reminded of the struggle of the black man in his abilities, especially some years ago, where the opportunities, although they were there, a lot of opportunities were not given to, I should say, no, we all have opportunities, but the struggle can be vastly different with the black male, even today, let alone years ago. And I could say, yes, that is a case. At the same time, I know that there are so many people who worked through whatever struggle they had to get to wherever they had to go. And I believe that at that point, it was saying, you're not going to use the system as a crutch. Go out there and make it happen. And today, unfortunately, a lot of families, male and, you know, with the husband and the wife, they're using the government assistance. And some of them, I'm going to be honest, some of them, they look like they can be doing whatever, and they're using the system. That's very true, and it seems to be a crutch. You know, they talk about the bridge card
I know here in Michigan, like it's just no big, like it's a credit card. Hey, I got my bridge card. I got my bridge card. You know, it's the big thing. One of my judge friends said that it was so, and he's a black male. He said it's so repulsive that he said he gets frustrated even in court, in his own chamber, because people would come that have, you know, have cases. The black men, the black young men, will come and have cases, and their parents or mother will be with them or whatever, and he'll say, well, what are you going to do as far as how are you going to eat? How are you going to work? Oh, don't worry about it. He's going to get the bridge card. You know, like it's, you know. So, unfortunately, the system has rendered a crutch for people, period, but it seems as though not only black people, but other cultures too, the Arabic community, I mean, people are using the system and taking advantage of it and using it and being able to fall back on it, when I believe in some cases they can really go and push forward to do whatever they have to do. But we do, in large numbers, use the system. And I don't see that a lot around my white friends. Some of them don't even know about the system like that. And when they figure they have to work, they just go out and work a few jobs, four or five jobs, and do what they have to do. I've seen that. I've seen that unfortunate comparison. I have. And I don't know. It's sad. It's sad.
Well, you know, Steve, once again, when we talk about the state of the black family, let me just ask you just a straight-up question. Do you think black families are in a better place now than they were, I don't know, 10 years ago, perhaps?
No, absolutely not. I mean, America.
Really?
Not even the American family. See, this is the thing. They talk about the black family, right? But just because white folks get married 7 years and get divorced, doesn't mean it's a strong family. If you want to get real technical, I can go 30, 50 year marriages, and about maybe only 10% of America can make it 50 years in a marriage. So we talk about strong families. America is very, extremely weak when it comes to families, if we want to compare it on a worldwide basis. Other nations are kicking our butt all across the board. You've got manhood, patriarchy all across the Eastern world, China, Russia, patriarchy very strong. So America is nowhere near what it used to be back in the day, nowhere near 1964, Lyndon Johnson's Great Society, which turned out not to be so great, and the welfare system, and I don't need a man. I don't need to listen to him. Guess what? The government said you can't be in this house. I can't get a welfare check. Guess what? It's time. You got to go. You got to get up out of this house. So, no, absolutely not. We were more together as a cohesive unit under slavery than we are today. That's my comment, Jay.
Wow. I mean, that's a strong statement. I don't know, Jerome. Are you back with us?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Your comments. I mean, I don't know. When you make that comment, Steve, we were more. Let me just let you answer that one, Jerome. What do you think about his comment?
I'm
mean,
not
God,
answering that. I can't. And the reason here's the thing. It's not that I can't. Never mind. Here's the thing. When this subject drives me nuts, I have a slight headache already, and it really, I kind of tune it out, because I think what happens is that we really get so much into bashing each other for stuff that's not really beyond our control, and we can't look at any factor but blame people who are kind of adapted to a system that has been meant to oppress them. So when we start talking about stuff, I mean, this is a serious side, so when we start talking about stuff, we really kind of have to look at it and be responsible about how we kind of assess stuff when we can. I'm not saying that we can, but when we can, we have to look at it and assess them. Now, technically, welfare, we don't have a welfare system anymore. It's been gone since Clinton. And when you start talking about what the building blocks were to create that system and how to stay on it, that is a whole nother story. It's a whole nother story about why people look forward to having, you know, cars to pay their whatever, public assistance. But the trick of all of that is, if you're oppressed in an oppressed area, especially in urban communities, yes,
some people depend on it because they can't get jack else. There's no fairness in hiring, and there's none of that. We're talking about earlier segment about 50 schools closing in the city. We blame them on overextending their credit because they ain't had no money, so they had to get credit. And then we still blame them for having too much credit. Like, it is, that drives me nuts. And so even in talking about generally, you know, of not understanding why we're in the situation, no, we don't need the military spending. We don't need to double it to $1.4 trillion. Like Elias said, the next 10 countries spend about $81 billion in military, and we spend $900 billion in military. So when we start talking about subjects like the black community and the state of black community, we don't like to take the factors in which create our outlook and create the reality in the black community and start picking them apart, like dissecting them. We say, how do we figure out a better way to live inside this jail? How do we get a flat screen inside this jail, right? We want to make ourselves comfortable in a system that has locked it down instead of trying to unravel the system to free people. Right, it is not everybody's fault that they are actually in a socioeconomic condition. It may be your fault to stay there to some degree, but if you don't know anybody, like, you know, when you say stuff like, I don't know any white folks that are like this, I do. There are a bunch of whole white projects. I mean, the majority of this country is not even occupied by black folks except for in urban areas. About 85 to 90% of all black folks are in urban areas. That's why urban areas get the stigma. But the farm subsidies and the subsidies in the Midwest, every time there's a tornado, you don't see black people in the project saying, don't get them fools no money. They live in the flood plains. That's why the land's cheap. We don't say stuff like that. So when we start overtly focusing on ourselves and blaming ourselves for stuff, this stuff is maddening. So I it's not that I couldn't answer the question. I just want to say we have to shed light on our topics in a way that is going to be constructive, because we can blame ourselves all day. That's what we've been doing historically anyway.
Interesting comment. Let's get out to the phone lines. Looks like we have Kavina Man calling in. Kavina Man, good morning. Welcome to the Serious Side. What's your comments, my man?
Hey, good morning, everybody. Yeah, I think that well, the state of black families today is collapsing, and I think it's dividing right now, just like, you know, white folks divide red state, blue state. I think that today's black society is being divided, segmented into many, many different segments. You know, I don't think we can no longer look at the black community as one community because we're so diverse, because we have a certain like generation. I'll be on the internet. Steve might know about this. I'll be on the internet battling people on Gen X and stuff. And it just seems that today's society has such an entitlement. Like today's youth, you know, you can't tell them, okay, this is the plan to get ahead. Go get an education, you know, go out and get a job, you know, stay off of crime or whatever. Today's youth is only interested in what you can actually give them. They don't want an education. They don't want opportunities. They just want you to give them a $40,000 or $50,000 a year job. And unless you just giving stuff to this young generation, they don't want to hear it. There's no longer an ethic of we're going to go out there and accomplish and defeat white supremacy and overcome things. It's only what can you give me now? I want the prize right now. There is no work ethic. And I think that you can trace that back to all the free money and the free housing and the free food stamps that, you know, that came along in the 70s and 60s. And I think that generation has grown up just expecting that somebody else is going to bring the solution to them. They don't have to go out and work for it.
Interesting comments, man. As always, appreciate you. Thank you. Thank you so much. Let's get back out to Ray. Looks like Ray wants to get in. Ray, good morning. Once again, comments. Is Ray with us live? Oh, I thought he
Sorry
wanted to get
that.
Back
Sorry
in.
About that.
Oh, okay, no, he's back with us. All right, go ahead, Ray. Sorry about that. Bring you back in. Yeah.
Well, we have to hold ourselves accountable, but not just on the lower end of the socioeconomic bracket. Those of us who have done well, I think one of the biggest mistakes we've made, it's not creating the opportunities for our youth, okay? myself included, you know, going towards corporate America and all that stuff. It's like I've decided I'm going to have to stop and I'm going to have to open a restaurant or something. I'm going to have to because our young black males have been targeted. It basically, it's a new Jim Crow with the criminal justice system. You have a lot of our youth that's flagged as felons. And it's pretty much blocking them out of any opportunity, not only just working, but also housing. So it's kind of one of those things to where if we, those of us who have done well and have actually accomplished things, we need to get out of these government jobs. We need to get out of corporate America and get out here. And some of us need to create these jobs because, you know, in 1950, that your first job most likely would have been in a black business. You know, we need to get back to that. To get them there and quit trying to go for security of some doggone job and get entrepreneurial spirit going and create these jobs for these youth and create these housing opportunities for our youth. Because if we don't do it, we can't expect anybody else to.
Yeah, absolutely. Get back in the game. All right, man. Appreciate that once again. Good comments and good to hear from you. I don't know how long you've been listening to the show, but it's good to have a
great
different
show.
Point.
I love it. I love it.
All right.
Stuff.
Appreciate it, man. Thank you so much.
And Jay, I would also like to add a point. White folks used to be, our black family was so strong in the 40s. It was even stronger than the white community. White folks used to be jealous of us on how strong our families were way back in the day. So that's another thing. When you look at the strength of the black family back in the day, it was great. It was the envy of the white folks, nowhere near as strong as the black family way back in the day. So it's a systematic, and they don't look at the think tanks. These guys are out here. These scientists, they know, these social engineers, they know what they're doing when they create these programs. They know how to systematically break down structures and Native Americans and target different groups and racial groups against each other and destroy the family unit from the inside. It's not the first time it's been done throughout world history. So, you know, they know exactly what their welfare has been done throughout world history. It's there to domesticate people and keep them, you know, dependent. That is what is done, therefore, so there won't be a bunch of civil unrest. You won't be a bunch of rioting in the streets, burning down homes and people burning down corporate America. They don't want all that. They want domestication. And so to sit here and say, blame everything on the white man, which is pretty kind of what Jerome's saying. I totally disagree with that.
Yeah, I know you do. Here's the thing. The thing is that no one, I can care less, and I can tell you this generally. I can care less about what anybody thinks, Jerome thinks, when it comes to this. This is probably the only thing that I normally don't speak about ever because I am very clear on this. The issue is, yes, just like bringing religion to people pacifies them. It keeps you from rising up against the government. But when you start talking about your own freedom and what you should do, think about the semi-truckloads of food that William Randolph Hearst was sending to the Black Panthers in Milwaukee. They got firebombed by the police department in Milwaukee. Were they doing anything to anybody? They had nursing or clinics in the community. They were only trying to help their own folks and see what happened to them. I am telling you, oppression is bigger than you think it is. It is not about, hey, if we stand up, that we can survive this. I am telling you, you have to hit it from different angles. This is nothing new. So as far as blaming ourselves for the condition, we can't even unravel ourselves out of the demonization of black people when you try to speak of your freedom. Most people hate LeBron because of the decision, because his contract expired. He did his obligation, his contract, and he did whatever the heck he wanted to. And look what media painted on that. Oh, my God. He gave $3 million to the Boys and Girls Club for how much they paid him. He didn't make a dime off of it. He did it and gave to his foundation, and people were like, oh, my God, I hate him. Any black man who speaks out with their freedom gets demonized. And so you can see any organization gets demonized. So don't come here acting as if, you know what, if we just lock arms and get together and save ourselves, we act like we won't get shot for that.
Now, deal with that as a reality. And that's kind of how history, that's what history has taught us. Now, we can do some things. I know in corporate, when we get interns, I would call some of the black, well, the people who I talk to, I said, come in my office, use my phone. They're monitoring your phone, our phones. So come in and use mine. Here's what you do when you do this. Make sure you stay away from this person. I would talk to them without actually having to make that visible to everybody else. I was teaching them to be smart about how they interacted in that world. But don't sit there and act like it's so easy in saying that, because you will get on the watch list like everybody else if you sit there and try to galvanize somebody against a system that's meant to oppress you. So it's not that simple. Go ahead.
Mm-hmm. 347-850-1272. 72 is our calling number, 347-850-1272. 72 is the J. Ryle Show, the Sirius Edition. It's 10 minutes, or should I say it's 30 minutes after the hour. We're at the bottom of the hour. We're talking about the state of black America, and we're focusing on the African-American family. And everyone has some good points. And let me swing around to you, Mr. Elias. I think that I see everyone's point of view on this. But I also know that when I turn on, you know, the first 48, the only thing I see are our people. Now, we could sit here and say that, you know, television executives are trying to show what's going on and, you know, they won't focus on other crimes and things of that nature. But I still have to think that if you see someone that's going the wrong way, that you have to say something. And for me, you know, yeah, there are opportunities out there for us, and there are people out, and there are situations where we are oppressed. You know, listen, like you said about Chicago, we're losing all of those schools, but, you know, the bottom, let's look at our hometown, for example. The reason why we're losing schools in our hometown is because, you know, yeah, funding may be an issue, but the biggest thing is kids have just dropped out. They don't even go to school anymore. So it's like, okay, what are we going to do with these schools? The kids are not going anymore, so now we have to consolidate and try to make schools or put schools in places where the statistics are telling us that the kids are trying to get an education. So there's, you know, there's two sides of the coin here, Mr. Elias, is it not?
So do we tell that child that's trying to get an education that because there are these other people who are not trying to get an education, and we just close the school down? I mean,
everything is dollars and cents, though, Mr. Elias.
Yeah, why doesn't it? Does the defense budget make sense, Jay?
But you're talking about
education for a child.
You're mixing apples and oranges, Mr. Elias. You really
are. How, Jay? How?
Because
we're spending billions and billions of dollars on a defense budget that don't mean crap. We don't even need the money to spend it on there. He's talking about a child's education. We're talking about not spending on enough money to if a child is trying to make some of himself. Are you kidding me?
No, I'm not kidding you. But see, the thing is that, and this is the thing that I think we all do, is that we sit here and think that one entity of government controls all entities. No, it does not. That's different funding. There are different things in place. What's going on in my household may be different than what's going on in your household. So you can't sit here and say that.
You can shift the funding, Jay. You can't sit here and tell me you can't shift the funding. We're spending how many billions of dollars on police in the world, and you're letting a child go hungry. You're letting a child not even get an education. You know, we're not putting forth the money to educate these children. We're closing down schools, talking about they've overspent so damn what.
But that's not a fair assessment either, Ms. Elias.
Why isn't it?
Because those kids they're busing those kids to those other schools. So if a kid wants to get their education, they're just going to have to go to another school district. But to sit here and say that I'm going to, we talk about capitalism.
Why not make the school district and their district better, Jay? Why are we sitting here?
But if the kids are not going to the school,
I don't care if it's one kid, Jay. That kid can make a difference in the world.
But Mr. Elias, but listen to what you're saying, though. That's okay. We all know that.
Look at how many billions of dollars we spend on defense. How many people are getting rich off a defense budget?
But Mr. Elias, you're casting pearls before swine. That's what Jay's saying.
How, Steve?
How? Because they need to come. But they're going to send the school bus and send those kids to a suburban school. Let them do that.
Let them
Why can't we make the schools in our own education?
The kids aren't going to school. There's not enough
Some kids
are
going to school, Steve. You know, I look at everybody talking about the Chicago situation. You know, I'm seeing all these parents going out there to fight to keep their schools open because these kids don't want to bust their kids to another situation. But yet and still, we can sit here and say we can spend billions and billions of dollars on a defense budget that don't mean nothing, that don't mean a damn thing, that makes another defense contractor rich.
But, Mr. Elliott, we can spend $100 trillion on education, but if parents are not sitting down with children, teaching children how to learn, it's not going to – you can spend $100 trillion on education.
Hey, Steve, you look at the Chicago situation, there are parents out there fighting to keep these schools open.
But they're not going to school.
So you want to shift these kids over to another different venue so they can learn here. Why can't we learn in our own environment?
But Mr. Elias, if the outcomes are better, where they're going to get better education in the suburbs, and they're willing to get free
in the cities.
They're willing to get free transportation to the burbs. Let them take those kids and get educated in the burbs. Let them take them
really?
And get educated in the burbs. Let them do that.
Why?
Because white folks don't want them in the suburbs in the first place. They're offering an opportunity saying, hey, you can come to the suburbs and get an education at our school. We don't mind integrating the schools. So that's white folks handing out a benefit. You don't see that?
No, Steve. No, you know what it is? It's putting these kids in a difficult situation. I went to an all-white school. I went to an all-white school. And all I got was nigga this, nigga that, nigga this, nigga that. So,
you know, Mr. Elliott, they did the same thing to me, and I whipped some heads and got some respect.
That's so many years ago, Mr. Elliott. I don't believe that it's like that now. Like,
yes, it is. It's worse. It's worse now.
Really?
I can tell you.
I raised my children in the suburbs. They go to suburban schools where they are predominantly white, and they've always been in that case. And I'm going to tell you, my son is, well, when he was younger, he had one experience. One. Where they ended up being their best friends today.
Go down south, Dr. Gillian. Go down south and tell me something differently. Go down south and bust it.
I'm not coming south.
Go to the suburbs of Chicago and tell me something different.
Well, I mean, they're prejudiced out here, too. They are prejudiced. I'm just saying, like, they haven't experienced. He was called a nigger once in the seventh grade. And that was a big shock because they have been in, you know, the suburbs for all his school years. And he was called a nigger. And, you know, we're actually friends with the family, and he's best friends with the young guy. Eventually, they all worked it out, and we even had a talk about it. But the prejudice is there. It's not as outward, I guess, maybe in the South so much. But they do have it here. But I think the education is very important.
Okay. And Mr. Elias, the root of poverty is the family. You cannot fix poverty without fixing the family unit. It is not possible. So you'll continually see that.
Go ahead, Steve. Finish your thought. Go ahead, finish your thought.
You'll continually see generational poverty without a strengthening of the family unit, because somebody has to be there to teach those children how to think, how to critically think, how to learn, to love learning, to read books, to get off the video game. Somebody has to teach those children and raise those children to just throw them in a public school and say, figure it out for yourself. You got a school built out of golden walls. That's not going to work because they're not being raised right. You never have a strong community without strong family. It's just not going to happen, Mr. Elias.
All right, it's 38 minutes after the hour. You're listening to the Serious Side of the J. Ron Show. Happens every Sunday morning right here on the TGRS Radio Network, online radio. At its best, our phone number is 347-850-1272. Our calling number is 347-850-1272. We're talking about the state of Black America, and we're focusing on the Black family. Very passionate conversation going on. You know, the thing I was saying, Mr. Elias, and look, trust me, you have valid points. There's no doubt about that. But the thing is that we talk about capitalism. We talk about money. You know, the reason why those schools were closed down, I'm not talking about our kids going out to the white suburbs, because that's not the case in the 219. The case was is that the kids were dropping out. The kids weren't going to school. And so you had a situation where, okay, we're not going to have a school that really facilitates, you know, 6,000 or 8,000 or 10,000 students open to, you know, for 200 students to attend. I mean, you can't, from a money standpoint, it's just not feasible. So it's like, okay, let's get these kids. What you think about it? If you open up, let me ask you a question.
Okay.
Let me ask you a question, and then I'll be quiet and let you have the floor. And here's the scenario: there's a town of 200 people. A town of 200 people. Are you going to open a super Walmart in that town where it's only 200 people and there's no one within 100 miles? How much sense does that make?
Jay, I can show you towns here in the in Indiana where the towns are so small that they have just opened up schools and they built state-of-the-art schools for less than the
well, then you need to show me that, because I hear you. You need facts then.
It's called, what is it called?
Why you thinking that? Here's my comment to that. But who wrote the check for that school are not the same people writing checks for schools in Gary, Indiana. I mean, we talk as if there's one checkbook and that all of a sudden, okay, well, if we're spending money on defense, then we can spend money on education. Listen, the federal government is trying to do everything in their power at the federal level to fund education. But is that trickling down to the states? I mean, you have the state government, you have local and city government. There's so many hands that it has to pass through. To sit here and say that, okay, because we're buying new tanks, but we're not putting a new school in the section of Gary, Indiana, that's a false statement.
No, we're not spending the money on teachers, Jay. That's my point.
Mr. Elias, you might have to lay off police officers if you don't have the money. You might have to lay off some police. You have to make choices on what you want. I would rather have police officers in the whole country.
They don't have to make choices on the defense budget that they spend on. Hell, all they do is write a damn check. They don't have to make the choice on that. All they have to do is write a damn check and go on about their business.
Well, then the value of the dollar comes down. See, everything affects everything.
Hey, Jay, can I get in on this?
Absolutely. What do you have, Jerome?
Okay, you know, I've been trying to get in for a while just because you guys are jumping on LES like he's saying something that's incorrect. And the problem is that not to understand that when they were laying off police, teachers and fire folks, it was because the federal government would not approve the money through the Department of Education that's filtered to the state, to the schools. But more importantly than that, because it is a case of school district being allocated money. I mean, Detroit's having that problem because the government of Michigan promised them some money and then took it back. Right? Now they're broke. So you can't do that because the way school district budgets work is they every year are promised a certain amount of money and they build their curriculums or their funding, keeping the lights on, based upon the money that's allocated to them during the budget year. And then some point in the middle of the year they say, oh, we don't have as much money, and then they cut that money. So when you don't give the money to the schools that you promised to give to them and then you blame them for having budget shortfalls, that is just kind of misleading. So LES is right. Is when the funding comes down, they are sifting off the funding for better schools, taking away from the other schools, and then they're blaming the schools. So I want to say this really quick because I had this conversation yesterday with a different educator. The bigger thing that we're missing about what's going on in urban schools in particular is what happened in the 70s, in the late 60s, early 70s. Once the Watts riots happened in the 60s and all that stuff happened, they changed curriculum to get black students more interested in school. We had more black
teachers' aides and all of that to keep us in school. And then they change the curriculums back. They don't have a lot of black teachers in there, so they don't really care about you. And I can tell you from growing up like this that I went to a school, my high school was primarily a white school. And I can tell you when I went into our summer program, I had black teachers, and my grades were 1,000 times better. So I go back to the white school and they say, man, you're doing so much better. It wasn't because of y'all. So you talk about shipping people out to suburban schools if you want to, but the white folks there don't care about you as individuals. What they'll do is they'll set up a streamlined in-school suspension program and start carting them off directly to jail.
I don't really have to comment on that
because the issue is that your perspective.
Let him finish that,
Dr. Prince O'D, then you can make your comment. Go ahead, finish up, Jerome.
Right, but the thing is that everybody's experience as individuals are different, but we're just talking about a systemic problem of how systems work and how those systems cart people off. So I know in the city I look, and again, I work closely with government a lot, so I can tell you how they determine what those funds are and what schools they're closed to are based upon their proximity to the good white schools. Like there's an elementary school that they want to close, but the school probably within a mile's radius was one of the best in the area, right? They forced, the white folks forced the school district to keep that school open because they didn't want the black students going to that school.
Wow.
They forced them.
Wow.
But how are you going to have a good, how are you going to reduce poverty without strong families? It still goes back to the foundation. I really want to say something. Go ahead.
All right, Steve, let Dr. Prince O'Dea get us all in. Go ahead, Dr. Prince O'Dea.
Okay, this is what I want to say. Now, first of all, I don't know about any other state, but where I raised my children, there were services and things in place in the suburban school that were not even, they had anything remotely close to what the suburbs had in the city. Now, listen, both of my children, my son was extremely, extremely brilliant, and he was in a gifted school at first. And then he went to, I had sent him actually to a school in the city when he was young because it was a Coleman A. Young school and it was ranked in the nation as top. And I figured, okay, let me see if he can do this for a year. And he had great programs, I thought. The classes were overcrowded. The attention was not given to the students sufficiently. It was really just not a good situation. My son was jumped on. Even one of the kids banged his head up against the brick of a school wall, school building, when he was in he must have been 6 years old, just because he was dressed too preppy. And they went on my son. So I had to take him out of there, and we just went to the suburban schools, you know, where in which we live. And he was diagnosed with ADD because they said, well, you know, he's really bright, but he needs something to help him focus because he's so bright. I said, okay, whatever. But I didn't want him to have that kind. I didn't want him to be medicated. Took him out to the suburban schools. They had the ParaPro, where the ParaPro is where the teacher, they have an extra teacher in the classroom, so they're able to kind of, you know, help him stay focused with his materials, et cetera. They don't do it for him. They just help him stay focused, and they have programs. And now I'm going to tell you, I have known black people to come into the suburban schools and somehow feel like they don't have a voice. Like, well, I don't know. Maybe, you know, they just go with whatever is given to them. Have I had some encounters with teachers at times that I know for a fact they didn't call and tell me, like my son had a C. And they say, oh, he's doing well. When I ask the teacher, how's my son doing? Oh, he's doing very well. I get the progress report and he's got a C. And I say, how did you think that was very well? I mean, he can do better than that. What's going on? Well, he's missing this assignment or that assignment. What the hell? Why didn't you say that? And I had to defend, had to go to bat and tell them, look, I'm not feeling like I'm privileged to be in your area. I want the same thing that you're giving everybody else. If you know that you will call another parent because their child is slipping below their normal standards and you give them a call and you pay attention to them, I want you to pay attention to my child, too. Because let me tell you about me. So I think that I just don't see that. I see that it has been a tremendous help for my children and many others that I do know that have come into the areas. I mean, it's up to us, too. A lot of us are mentally, in our minds, we feel like we don't have. We go even into the areas that we are afforded more opportunity, and we still feel like we are a slave to it, like we can't speak up. It's terrible. I mean, I don't know. I just don't see that.
Well, Princess Odelia, psychologist, psychiatrist will even tell you that white children have higher self-esteem levels. So
that's why the black family.
Because
we are so oppressed mentally.
Oh, I know.
We are so oppressed mentally in the home. That's why these children are like they are.
I know, you're right.
But I'm
linking that to the black family. See, people think money will fix everything. People don't understand that money does not fix everything. Money cannot force my girlfriend to act right if she's not acting right. Money cannot force it cannot force children to get educated. People don't understand. It takes a family unit. It takes parents. It takes strong mothers. People don't get that. They think they can just throw money at a problem and it will disappear. The problem will not disappear. It's not necessarily always a money issue. It's not.
I don't think our parents are stepping up to the plate in the way they should. I believe
Thank you so much for bringing that up, because I was getting ready to say that we've had this conversation for the past 40 minutes. Not one time did anyone say anything about parents. My mother's an educator, and my mother was an educator for 35-plus years. And the thing that always frustrated her was the lack of participation with our people coming up to the school, talking to the teachers. They would invite the parents to come. The parents wouldn't show up. And so we can sit here and say, you're right. Everyone's right. I mean, there are systems in place that are oppressing these kids. There's no doubt about it. But then we need to look at the parents, because there are parents out there who are not doing what they need to do. So I want to say kudos to you and Steve both for bringing the P word into the conversation, because we haven't talked about that. The parent's name has not come up one time. And let me tell you something. It starts in the home. We can sit here and say what we want. It's just like the conversation we had a few weeks ago, Mr. Elias, about, you know, missing children of color. We say that, okay, the focus is on, you know, white kids, but one of the things I love about what Miss Terry said to us is that let's not be short about it. White parents are out there trying to do what they need to do to get their kids in the media. Now, don't get me wrong, there are situations where, you know, if they're pretty blonde hair and blue eyes, you know, that's a whole different ball game. But, you know, bringing it back to this topic, we still have to look at, there is a responsibility that the parents have in this situation, and we have not addressed that yet.
Yeah, well, you know something, Joe, I'm sorry to tell you, I brought up the parents earlier, but then again,
okay, well, I didn't hear you. I apologize.
When I said the parents in Chicago were fighting for their children to go to that school, they were fighting.
Well,
yeah,
I hear you. Yeah.
There's
parents
fighting for, you know, not all black families. Steve, I disagree with you. The lack of money is what's killing the black family. Now we can sit here and say that, you know, if you put a black child and a white child, you give them the same advantages, there's not going to be any differences. You know, if that black child has a mother that's a lawyer or a father that's a doctor, there's not going to be any difference. These children are going to get the same advantages as a white child. So when we sit here and say is you can't just throw money at it, you can't throw money at it, Steve, because if you get that father and that mother there, and they're making enough to provide for that child, and they're able to take off work and be there at that school for that child, guess what happens? The same advantages.
I don't think he's saying, but yeah, I agree with you, but I think that and I don't want to speak for you, Steve, but what I think Steve is saying is you just can't exclusively throw money at the problem and think that's going to resolve the issue. I mean, yeah, money plays a role with anything. I mean, it's just like anything in life. You can't, you know, you can't do anything without money. But to sit here and say that, you know, well, we're going to build the best schools in the world. You know, I've said this a thousand times. You can have there are kids, you know, I live in a neighborhood, and I live in an area where, you know, they have some of the best schools in the nation. But there are still some kids that refuse to go to that. It's that whole scenario where you can, you know, you can take the horse to the water, but you can't force them to drink. And, you know, to sit here and say that, you know, there's not a problem on both sides of the fence, I think it's a false statement. Yeah, I do agree with Jerome. I think that we need to spend more time focusing on the positives of what we do, and we shouldn't sit here and demoralize and demean our people. But at the same time, to me, you have to call a spade a spade. And I know that there are parents. I know people who, you know, you say your kid in school, they went that way. Well, okay, what are you doing? When was the last time you participated in PTA? You know, white people do that. I don't participate in that stuff. Really? Come on. So why are you running around here with green hair and tattoos looking, your kid looks like you, and y'all looking crazy together, and your kid out here, you know, robbing and stealing and drugs? I mean, there is something to it, and it starts at the home, in the home. And to sit here and say that it doesn't, I think you're being naive. I think people are being naive when you sit there and say that the parents don't play a role in this thing.
You know, it definitely starts in the home, but you know what? Also, too, you have the parents, and that's what I'm talking about, the oppressed mentally. And it's not to bash our community. It's just a fact that the oppression is a fact. We were given a script, as all people in the United States, you know, we're told exactly how the system is supposed to go. You're supposed to go to school, get your education, further your education after high school, and graduate and get the nice house and the big ticket fence. You know, that's what we were raised to believe and to expect. And when the system fails, because most people were not accustomed to thinking for themselves or to create, to have entrepreneurship ideas, to really go to the limits beyond the system, beyond a certain infrastructure, they walk around depressed, oppressed, and they tell their children, look, you're not going to be anything if you don't do school, you're not going to do this, and da-da-da-da-da, if you don't do this, and don't do that. And then they end up, a lot of the children are medicated. You know, it's just, it's a cycle of, unfortunately, where people are passing the buck. So the kids go to school, and they're distraught. I know children that go to the nice schools and say, well, I don't want to go over there because, you know, they're prejudiced, or they're this, or they're that. Instead of us teaching our children, look, let's not focus on that. Focus on your education. Don't try to, you know, drill your children, you know, with the concept that, you know, everybody's against them, that the white man's against them and all of that. Keep that conversation out of the house. When things are going bad, us parents, we need to learn positive thinking and thought. We need to learn strength and to present that to our children so that the children do want to go to school. They'll be motivated. You know, I heard someone say in some area, the kids aren't going to school. Well, why aren't they going to school? What's the situation? Maybe is the parent at home saying, you know, oh, I can't believe they did this, and focusing all on the negative, not infusing the children with positive thinking, and which creates hope. I mean,
I agree with you. Let me say this. I agree with some of what you said, Dr. Prince's idea, but at the same time, I do think that to sit here and say, or don't tell your kids, you know, it's just like anything else. If you walk in a room, and I know if there's someone behind that door that's going to knock you upside your head, I think it's my responsibility to tell you that. So to sit here and say that it doesn't exist, you know, I think that's wrong, too. I think you have to be.
I
heard what you said. What you said was, is that, you know, why tell your kids the white man's trying to keep it down, keep them down, keep that thought out of their head. I think you have to equip your kid with knowledge, whether it's good, bad, or indifferent, and then, you know, and let them navigate their ways through that. To me, that's not cool.
No, but I'm saying some parents, that's a conversation at home. That's the energy at home. I educated my children to certain things, but I didn't make it a conversation. Right after I educated them, I let them know what hope they have and what is up to them. I've always put it, the responsibility of life, of everything, back into their lap, even as a child, so that I was sure that I wasn't raising a slave. I wasn't raising slaves in my house. I was raising free thinkers, free doers and letting them know that they have options. And no one monkey can stop no show. It's up to you. Period, flat out. I didn't talk to my and drill my son about, oh, the black man is down. I never talked like that. Never, ever, ever. And he has not allowed that to stop him. Everything he's gone forward, he's gotten, you know, as a young black man. I think it really is up to us to make changes first on the way we think about things, the way we think about bad times, things that are our valleys. I don't even want to call them bad. I want to say our valleys in life. We get in a valley and we just, oh, Lord, I'm oppressed. I can't do it. I can't. It's the mindset, and they're teaching we're teaching their children that. So yep. The children don't All have right. hope when they go forward.
All right, well, we're coming up to the top of the hour. We're going to close it out. I want to just go around the room here real quick and just, okay, give me something positive. Okay, even though we're talking about the African-American family, and I think for the most part, you know, at least from my standpoint, Mr. Elias, I see more two-family homes, two-parent homes, I should say. You know, it's not like you and I. You know, I remember I was in a room and I asked, there were like, I don't know, 15 brothers in the room, and all 15 of the brothers, when I asked them, did their father grow up with them, they said no. And I thought that was astonishing. And the fact that being in the military, you travel from place to place, you meet people from different parts of the world in the country. You know, it was always that 90% ratio of when I asked people, did they have two parents in the house, all of them would say, hey, you know, my dad wasn't around. So it seems to me, if I had to give a positive and a negative, I'll start it off. My positive is I see more two-parent families, and I think that maybe the message is starting to get across where, you know, you don't want to grow up as a single, you know, in a single-parent home. And there's nothing wrong with that because, look, I was, I grew up in a single-parent home. But I think that because of the fact that, you know, I didn't have that other parent around, that I made it a point to make sure that I would not be in a situation like that. So I think the positive for me, and I'm going to ask you guys this, I think the positive for me is I do see more two-parent homes. I do see more African-American kids really going out there and doing their thing. But on the other side of that, I also see where we still have situations where we have to reach out, you know, to urban America because there are places, you know, in the country where, you know, a kid's way of life is making money. They're hustling. They're trying to sell drugs and do those types of things. Let me ask you, Mr. Elias, give me a positive and a negative, man, of what you see in the African-American community as far as black families are concerned.
Well, the negative is education, man. You know, it seems like the negative in the black education is that we're trying to destroy the schools. You know, we're trying to get rid of the schools. We're trying to eliminate schools in the black communities. The positive that I see is that, to be honest, I'm starting to see a lot more fathers step up to the plate in the black community. That's what
I see. What about you? What about you, Steve?
Well, okay, there we go. Well, basically, the positives I see is that you're seeing black leaders. I mean, like President of the United States, Barack Obama, somebody that looks, identifies, people see themselves. Black, he's black. And then, you know, you go to Atlanta, black leaders, you know, mayor, different things of that nature. So you see a positive on that. The negative side, you know, like I said before, you know, money does not build character. Character builds money. You know, good study habits, motivation, drive. You know, that's the thing. I cannot force my girlfriend to act right just by, you know, buying her some ring or something. No, no. Money does not build character. Character builds money. And people, once they understand that those good study habits and that drive and motivation to be successful, that character builds money, then they'll understand we cannot throw unlimited amounts of money out there and think that it's magically going to produce success. It doesn't work like that. Character builds the money. That's the foundation, is character. And that's my comment on that, Jay.
What about you, Dr. Princess O.D.? Give me a positive and a negative. Did we lose Dr.
Okay.
Princess O.D.?
All right. Yep, no, but I was just on mute.
Okay.
The positive and negative. Positive and negative. Well, and you're talking about money. I was listening. I heard.
No, not money, Dr. Prince. I'm asking you to tell me something that's good that's happening in the black American
uh-huh.
families,
okay.
African American families, I should say, and something that you would like to see us improve on.
Okay, I would like to see us improve on our family circle. I would like to see single mothers and to be able to raise children, positive children, not bashing the man. I would like to see men to interact with the children, even though they may be out of the home. I would like to see more of a family structure. Even if the mom and dad chooses not to be together, I would just love to see that they would make a choice for the children to at least interact positively and not in a negative light and still be involved with the children. So I guess that's what I see that needs to be changed, and that's something that happens to be a negative. It is a very segregated. Our families are segregated, and that is not favorable at all for us. Positively, what I see is that I have to say I'm very happy with the black people and our role in entrepreneurship, that I believe that we've really stepped it up. We've taken charge in many cases of our own lives and pushing forward to start our own businesses and trying to seek how we can do better. So I am very, very proud of that for the black community, because although there are some things that are not favorable, it is very favorable in many ways as far as how
okay.
we have moved forward.
All right. All right, Jerome, give me something, man. Give me something that you think that we're doing great, and if there is improvement you'd like to see, what would it be?
I got nothing, and I'm going to take a zero. And the reason I'm going to do this is because I can't find anything out of the conversation. I couldn't pull anything because
yeah.
the way the whole conversation went, it was just pretty much the negative. It was pretty much the bashing of the community. I think we had enough negative,
uh-huh.
and I can't find that. And so I'll take a zero. I'll just kind of try to add something in my final comments probably.
Okay.
I don't know. Keep it moving.
Fair
my
enough.
Bad. I didn't
Fair
want to
enough.
Shit.
All right, Mr. Elias, man. Last word, brother. Mr. Elias?
Let's spend more money. Let's spend more money and time with our children. They are only allies to our future. So when we talk about children and looking at them and looking at as a whole. Why would we ship our children out to a different location to lose their own heritage, man? I mean, to me, you lose your heritage if you go to the suburbs, doesn't make it necessarily better. You know, like I said, you know, you got a school in Chicago, man, that these young men every year graduate with 100% success rate. That are going to college, and this is in the inner city. This is a school in the inner city. So when you tell me about a school in the suburb that can fortify and make it better, I'm looking at this school in Chicago that's doing it, and it's a hell of a school, man. I can't remember the name of the school, but I'll look it up and see. But this school is doing great things. So when you tell me you can't do it, there it is.
All right, folks, we're not done yet. Before we go, it's coming up next. Have a little fun, and of course, Chatterbox and our final thoughts. We're winding down. It's Sunday. We'll be right back to put a bow on it. Don't go anywhere.
The week that was in the news.
Also in New Jersey, some TGI Fridays customers may not feel so thankful this morning. Investigators accused some restaurants of cheating people who thought they were buying premium alcohol. Instead, they were getting cheap whiskey, rubbing alcohol, or water.
Can't be good. No. The year-long investigation was called Operation Swill. Officials raided 29 bars and restaurants on Wednesday. 13 of them were TGI Fridays. That's owned by the Briad Group. It's America's largest TGI Fridays operator. The president of Fridays USA said in a statement, quote, "We consider the alleged allegations to be very disturbing. If accurate, they would represent a violation of our company's values and our extensive bar and beverage standards."
When we first met Barbara Garcia a couple of hours after the tornado ripped through her neighborhood, she was searching through what was left of her home looking for her dog named Bowser.
So I know he's in here somewhere.
She told us she didn't think he'd made it, but moments later...
The dog.
That's our CBS producer who spotted something, moving under all that rubble.
Oh.
Here comes Cross, got the step in. What a move! It's out of the power! He beat LeBron James with a quick step. A sensational move by Paul George.
We are seeing a superstar in the making here with Paul George. Gets the step on LeBron James. The Birdman is just a little bit late, rotating over. And click, click. Birdman, this is your Kodak moment.
All right, folks, it is time for, before we go, a quick look at some stories that made headlines this past week. In the first story, TGI Fridays are lacing up the drinks. Mr. LES, man, can you believe that? Rubbing alcohol.
Hey, you know, well, hey, man, it's no different than any other, some of the restaurants I've been in my lifetime, man. I'm like, hey, is there any alcohol in this thing? And, hey, man, that's why I got my own bar at home.
You can't take your bar to TGI Fridays, Mr. Elias. Come on, stop
that's
it.
Why I order, that's why I order drinks outside. I drink at home, man.
Okay, Jerome, we're talking, they're drinking rubbing alcohol. See, I always thought that was, I guess you can't die from that. I thought you could die from rubbing alcohol if you drank it.
I think you could die from anything if you be drinking the wrong combination. So I didn't, yeah, that's strange. That was strange.
Thank you, Jerome.
Yeah, that was great.
All right, Steve, listen, man, food coloring water, bottom line is, do you have the stomach, if you were drinking, okay, do you have like a meter that detects bad drinks, Steve?
Absolutely not. I have a meter, and it'll probably be so expensive, man. You know, it's just unbelievable rubbing alcohol, man. It's just getting ridiculous out here. Yeah, man. It's just,
wow. Save a couple of bucks. Wow. All right, so listen, everyone knows about the tornadoes that torn through Oklahoma, but a very good story, Dr. Princess Aldea, old lady in her 70s, late 70s, lost everything. She was concerned about her dog. Well, while they were filming her, they found the dog. Very good story, huh? Okay, Dr. Princess Aldea, as usual, you do what you do.
No,
Jesus
no.
Christ.
No,
okay,
no,
you're there.
I'm here. Yes, I am. See, look, and you said all that. You're going to have to retract it.
Well, it was true. I'm not retracting anything.
This is the serious side of the Jay Rowell Show today. Thank
it
you.
Is.
Well, I
so for now. Yes.
I think it's very good. It's always hope in the midst of a storm. Always positive in the midst of a storm. We've had some great things happen. I mean, I think that all of the things that are happening, like the natural disasters, they happen. But in it, it's life always shows us how it's really not as bad as we thought that it was, or there's always still hope, and I'm very grateful for that. So that's good.
All right.
Good positive story.
All right, so look here, guys. We're going to get a mulligan here. Oops, something happened along the way to the championship. The Indiana Pacers have shown up. All right, Jerome. What you think, brother? Do you think Indiana can pull this thing out?
Okay, do you allow cursing on your show? Because I'm going to say, hell no. I like the haters, though. It seems like there is joy. What is it? Schadenfreude, right? There's the joy and the misery of others. People want to see the champions go down, and they're really happy. It's 1-1. Let Indiana keep that up.
It should be 2-0. Don't even try it. It should be 2-0. I don't want to hear that mess.
Okay. I want to refer you to Exhibit A, Chicago Bulls. Remember how happy everybody was? Oh, my God. I don't care if you win by 1 or 30. It's game. It's a game. It's 1-1.
Okay.
People get happy,
you know what?
When the big guy loses. I don't know what that is.
I told Hater. You. Let me tell you something.
Hater.
I said. Okay, fine. All right, Steve, talk to me, man. Do you think Indiana can pull this thing out?
Well, yeah, I mean, you got Hibbert putting up Shaquille O'Neal numbers.
They have no answer for him. They have no answer for him. None.
Exactly.
Zilch.
You know, and LeBron, he can't – the weight is not 100%. He's got a bad leg, and LeBron, you know, he can't do it all by himself. And, you know, their defense last year was ninth, not Indiana's number one. You got Paul George – becoming a superstar, all this stuff at the same time, it's just too much to handle, I believe.
I agree. Mr. Elias, man, our hometown Pacers, baby, what do you think?
I think anything is possible, but, man, we got to wait and see.
You know what? I'm going to go ahead and go on. I think Indiana's going to beat them in 6 games. Indiana is going to win that series. Watch what I say.
Didn't you say Rhymes was going to
win? That's the same thing Charles Barkley said, too.
Okay, nobody's talking to you guys.
Didn't both of you guys think Romney? I just want to say that for the record. Just in case you report.
Hey, Jerome, you can go to hell. How about that?
I'm not going.
Oh, my God. And on that note, oh, my God. It is time for Chatterbox final thoughts from the chat room. And, of course, we encourage you guys to participate. And, as always, I'll take a stab at it first. I have one in here from a lady by the name of Barbara. Barbara says, look, black people need to stop making excuses as to why our kids are robbing and stealing. Video games, rap music, and drugs are all corporates. What do you have, Ms. Elias?
I Am the Universe, where I Am the Universe says, I Am Nixon stated in the early 70s. Now, one way to say we're growing infrastructure in the United States of America.
All right, we have one from our favorite listener, Kavina Manny. He says, listen, the school systems works for those that use it, but those who just want to party, ball, and do drugs, the school can teach them. And I think he meant the school can't teach them. I'm not sure. All right, folks, that is it. All right, look, we'll be back. We have a Have You Seen Me coming up. We also have a news update. And then we'll be back with our final thoughts. Don't go anywhere, folks. Last call coming up right here on the Sirius side.
Sir, have you seen this girl?
Hello, friends. I'm Jay, the host of the Jay Rowell Show and the Serious Side of the Jay Rowell Show. And it's time for another edition of Have You Seen Me, where we put the spotlight on missing children of color. Today we are focusing our attention on young Myra Howard, 16, who went missing at around 10 a.m. April 29th.
Myra told her brother that she was on her way to school that day when she disappeared, but her family later found out that there was no school that day. A search of her Facebook account and phone records revealed that Myra was reportedly meeting up in Los Angeles with a 23-year-old man who she met online. The man reportedly picked her up near Vermont Avenue and Manchester Boulevard in Panoma, Washington. She left money behind at home and did not take any clothing, indicators that she did not likely run away. Preliminary searches have revealed that the teen might be hanging with a group of individuals suspected of being involved in a sex trafficking ring. Myra is described as an African-American teen who is 4 foot 10 inches tall, weighs around 100 pounds. She has medium-length brown hair and brown eyes. She also has several new tattoos, including praying hands, a dream catcher, and the word Scooby on her back. Authorities believe that she obtained these tattoos while in the presence of these young men. She also has a medical condition that requires her to take iron pills. Anyone with any information about Myra's whereabouts is urged to call 951-660-8031. That number once again is 951-660-8031 or your local law enforcement office. We pray for the family of young Myra and we hope that she returns home soon. We have a quick update for you on Famai Kana from Brooklyn, who went missing Wednesday night from a bus stop. He was found safe. It's always good news. If you know of a person that you would like to see featured on Have You Seen Me, all you have to do is contact us. You can contact us via email at thejrileshow@live.com. That's thejrileshow@live.com. Or you can go to our Facebook page, the TGRS Radio Network, and leave some information there. Or you can contact me direct at JAYRIL on Facebook. Or you can call into the show during a live broadcast and leave your information there. We pray for the safe return of all people missing, regardless of color. I'm Jay Ryle, and you've been listening to Have You Seen Me? Sponsored by the TJRS Radio Network, online radio at its best. Until next time, take care.
Somewhere in America, a mother is crying.
A family is torn.
A child is lost,
missing, or even abducted.
We need your help!
Contact your local police station for a listing of missing children in your area,
or log on to www.missingkids.com
to obtain further information regarding missing children in your local community.
Because the next face you see
may be a child that will need your help.
Help support America Missing!
You are listening to the TJRS Radio Network.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Giles Snyder. President Obama travels to Oklahoma today. As NPR's Scott Horsley reports, he'll get a first-hand look at the devastation left by last week's deadly tornadoes.
The president will meet with some of the families in Moore, Oklahoma, who've been affected by the storms. He'll also thank the first responders who turned out to help after an EF5 tornado swept for miles through the area, obliterating whole neighborhoods and leaving 24 people dead. This visit, like so many others the president has made, is meant to show that Americans stand together following disasters, both natural and man-made.
We've seen that spirit in Joplin and Tuscaloosa. We saw that spirit in Boston and Breezy Point. And that's what the people of Oklahoma are going to need from us right now.
On Tuesday, the president makes a follow-up visit to the New Jersey shore, where he'll check out ongoing recovery efforts after last fall's Hurricane Sandy. Scott Horsley, NPR News, the White House.
In San Antonio, Texas, emergency workers rushed this weekend to rescue more than 200 people stranded in homes and cars when water from torrential rain unexpectedly rose up to 4 feet in some spots. Charles Hood is the chief of the San Antonio Fire Department.
We risk a lot to save a lot. And so in these instances, our firefighters made ultimate sacrifices in several of these rescues where we actually put 8 boats into the water.
Nearly 10 inches of rainfall reported in a matter of hours at the city's airport, and its height, a flash flood warning covered nearly 24 Texas counties. The flash flooding is being blamed for killing 2 people, and authorities are still searching for a teenage boy who was swept away as he tried to cross a rain-swollen stream. The weather in the area is expected to improve today. Searchers in upstate New York are still looking for a missing pilot whose small plane crashed in the region on Friday. Most of the plane ended up in a pond near the town of Ephrata, about an hour west of Albany. Divers are expected to use sonar because the water is muddy and murky. Fox News officials professed indignation and surprise last week over the search of reporter James Rosen's records amid a federal leak investigation. But as NPR's David Folkenflik reports, prosecutors told Fox's parent company that a subpoena nearly 3 years ago.
Prosecutors issued a subpoena for Rosen's phone records and got a judge to sign off on a sealed warrant for his emails back in May 2010. The Justice Department informed News Corp lawyers in August 2010 of the phone record search, but a Fox executive and a News Corp spokesman tell NPR that vital information was never shared by News Corp with Fox's executives or lawyers. Hence, they say Fox's expressions of outrage last week were real. The disclosure does not change the anger of journalists toward a series of aggressive leak inquiries, but News Corp spokesman Nathaniel Brown says the company is reviewing its apparent oversight, which he says just came to light. David Folkenflik, NPR News, New York.
This is NPR News.
All right, folks, it is time for our final thoughts. We're under 2 minutes. I'm going to ask everyone to make it short and brief. Let me start with you, Steve. Final thoughts.
Yeah, you know, character really is the solution. You know, it's a solution for relationship problems, solution for educational, a lot of educational problems, not all of them. But, you know, character builds so many things. You see people hitting a power ball. You see people... you know, just pretty much just have it all. It's just the lack of character. You know, a fool and his money are soon departed, the Bible says. Because character makes it last. Character builds it for the future. Character reinvests it and makes it prosperous and grows. It takes character to have good study habits. Character to apply for that applicant job. It really does take character. And and that's my final comment, Jay. And go Pacers, go. God bless you all. Have a great day.
I appreciate you, man. Dr. Princess O'Dea, we're less than a minute 30. Give us your final thoughts.
Okay. I'm trying to work this thing out because I want to share a quote that I wrote earlier this week.
Well, let me just say goodbye to everyone now because we're not going to get done. So everyone who's listening, take care. God bless. And if you want to hear our final comments, you can always tune in to the after show. But right now, we're going to definitely go over. Dr. Princess O'Dea, your final thought.
Okay. The quote was actually small, but anyway, you know, Father's Day is coming up in the next month. And I was just thinking about as a result of me talking to a teenager this past week who had been chronically running away. And a lot of her issue had to do with the absenteeism of her father. And she was running away and actually going into, you know, she's been dealing with transference where she's dealing with young men to fill that void. And I wrote this quote, a fatherless daughter oftentimes turns to a man as her drug when she grows older. She'll do anything to get her fixed. Father, are you there for yours? I just want to admonish fathers, step it up. Step it up. This is very important for us to stay focused on our children, our sons too. Mothers and fathers, come together, work together. Even if you're not together as a unit, as an item, you can come together as a family unit. So many things take place. Even these missing girls, the boys, most of them are young girls. They're missing and acting. A lot of them are running away because parents aren't listening and parents aren't there. And that's my word. We it's up to us to step up to the plate. And I'd like everyone to visit me on Facebook, Jack the Prince of Avilia, and also don't forget to tune in to Transformers Enjoy TV. And the shows will be, YouTube page will be in Jordan. And I don't know if the show is still going on or not. Jay, are you there?
Yeah, it's still going on, Dr. Princess O'Dea. We're just waiting till you're done so we can do our final thoughts.
All right.
Wow. Have a good day, everyone. I love
you
all.
Oh, thank you, Dr. Princess O'Dea. God bless you as well. All right. Jerome, final thoughts. Jeez.
I'm going to take a zero. I'm just joking.
Oh, no.
I'm going to take a half on that. Okay, so... I feel pressure. All right, well, since we are already in the archives, I did have a request that I just still do what I was going to do. So quickly, since we had a lot of negative, let me tell you this. A video about the so-called crack baby scare of the 80s, the epidemic, the Retro Report came out. It's a nonprofit documentary that came out with the New York Times. It said the worrisome exploitations by researchers, in retrospect, was rather overblown and misleading. I can tell you a lot about that, but that was a joke of saying how people were going to be crazy because of drugs. And 16-year-old Florida honor student Kara Wilmot, who was accused of igniting that chemical explosion on school grounds, she and her twin sister received a scholarship this week to the United States Advanced Space Academy, Space Camp.
Wow.
So they're going to be there. So tell the good news in the story, as everybody said, throwing her in jail for creating an explosion on campus. It was science, people. Get off her. Now, according to Variety, Janet Jackson has officially become a billionaire, and her personal wealth is exceeding $1 billion. Talking about they want Michael's money, because Michael has never officially had $1 billion in cash. He had assets over $1 billion, but Janet has more money than Michael has.
Well, wait a minute now. Is that true now, even though the fact that he's making money now that he's dead? I mean, is that still true?
That's true that his assets was more. The Beatles catalog by itself was worth $1 billion. So he was worth more, but she has more cash. She has $1 billion in cash. I can break that down, but I just didn't think we had time. I can tell you where that money's coming from. But generally, yeah, it's cash. That's how you make the $1 billion list.
Okay, I appreciate it, man.
Would you like more?
Wait, you got something else?
I just wanted to make sure I threw that out there.
Well, I'm glad the show was ending on a very funny note. It was pretty harsh in there for a minute. All right, Mr. Elias, Megan's first and last word. What you got, Doc?
Well, you know, something, man, is that the Chicago Prep School, for the third year in a row, has graduated 100% of their 100% of their seniors. It's an all-male school. And they send these kids to college. Every one of these kids are going to college. You know, I mean, so when we look at education, let's look at education for real. Let's look at education as it's supposed to be. You know, just because it's in the, I'll say it again, just because it's in the suburbs doesn't make it a better school. You know, put the money back into where it belongs, into education, man. And stop spending so much money on defense.
You know, tomorrow is Memorial Day, and, you know, a lot of time, you know, most people are going to be out barbecuing, you know, having fun with friends and doing all those types of things. But I want people to really and truly remember the true meaning of the holiday. I mean, there are family members who have lost people who went to war, and they're never coming home. And so as we sit back and want to grab the ribs and play dominoes and yell who you with, let's think about those families who are in situations that are completely different, where they are mourning the loss of a loved one, regardless of whether it was just here recently in the wars that we're involved in now, or it could have been a war back in the 60s. Regardless, let's remember the true meaning of the day. And on that note, Mr. Elias, if it's Sunday and we're talking serious things, my friend, what time is it?
It's time for the serious side of the day. Wow. Show.
All right, that's a wrap. So enjoy your holiday weekend. For Jerome, for Steve, for Dr. Prince O'D, and my main man, Mr. Elias, I'm Jay. God bless. Go Pacers!
are listening to the TJRS Radio Network.